You're listening to The Block Experience, all things decentralized and open source. Enjoy.
Hey everyone, sorry to interrupt the podcast here. I just want to say this episode of The Block Experience is brought to you by our first sponsor, PrimeXBT. Whether you're looking to trade some of your favorite cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Litecoin, or even venture into other markets, PrimeXBT always has you covered. PrimeXBT offers traders access to a large variety of markets, including cryptocurrencies, stock indices, commodities, and even Forex pairs, and also have some incredible features such as anonymous accounting, Bitcoin deposits and withdrawals, industry-leading security, and even the ability to offer 1,000 times leverage. I've personally been using PrimeXBT for my trading for the past few months and have had a great experience using the platform, also using the platform's customer service. So I'm really proud that they're supporting this episode of the podcast, bringing you guys free podcasts every week. A link to the services PrimeXBT provide will be below, also a link to sign up to a new account. So thanks again, PrimeXBT, for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. And yeah, I hope you continue and like the podcast. Enjoy. I really appreciate you coming on today, Scott, and just obviously it's a bit of a crazy time, so taking the time out of your day when you're with your family and stuff during this time, I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Just for those who don't know, I'm not probably sure it's not too many, but do you want to just give a quick introduction into who you are and what you're currently working on?
Sure. Yeah, my name is Scott Melker. I'm on Twitter as the Wolf of All Streets, but still at Scott Melker. My main career for most of my life was actually as a DJ and music producer for about 20 years, but I was trading kind of that whole time and really transitioned into full-time trading when my daughter was born and I wanted to get off the road and stop traveling. So that's been really the last just over 5 years. And now, you know, I trade full time. I run a Discord group with another trader. It's actually his group. He's my mentor, and I basically forced him to start a Discord so that I could continue to learn more from him. That's Chris Inks from Texas West Capital. Mm-hmm. And then I now have a newsletter, a podcast. I'm doing the whole, trifecta of a Twitter guy in the crypto community, for better or for worse. That wasn't my intention, but at the core, you know, trading is still where my heart is at and where my primary income is at.
How do you find that, like, newsletter and, like, podcast stuff? So I started this podcast 2 months ago now, and then I've also started a newsletter this week. So it seems like a lot of crypto people on Twitter, I guess, seem to start falling into these categories where they're producing not just tweets anymore, but better and higher scale quality content for the masses, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, for me, it was an opportunity to expand on the thoughts on my Twitter. When I realized that the things I was sharing there, you know, with the limited characters were resonating with people, it just seemed like sort of a layup for me to expand on those. I'm a pretty efficient worker. I've got pretty bad ADHD. So like that can lead to either, you know, being completely scattered or being hyper-focused. So when I really do hyper-focus in on something, which used to be music for me, but now, like, I can write a newsletter, which is effectively, some of the ones I put out are like, would be a magazine, you know, and I do it in a couple hours in a day. It's all my thoughts just pour out. So I've always found Twitter really limiting. So that was sort of my motivation. I figure, you know, if someone's willing to read it and I'm willing to write it, then there's no reason not to have it, you know? Yeah. And then the podcast fell into my lap, Blockworks Group. I don't know if you're familiar with them, yep. But they do sort of all the doxed dudes in crypto's podcasts. You know, they handle Pomp, Luke Martin, you know, Venture Coinist, Charlie Shrem, like kind of all those big names. And they actually approached me about doing a podcast. It was something that was on my radar, I guess, but not something that I was eagerly sort of pursuing. Yeah. And they just made it very easy for me. They were sort of like, listen, we produce it, we monetize it, we'll help you get guests, but you go out, get the guests, talk it up, and basically be creative. And for me, like when I was in music, I always had a manager and an agent and stuff. So I was, you know, I've always positioned myself where I could just do the work and let everybody else handle all the bullshit, you know, to whatever degree. And so that was a very, for me, that was an extremely attractive proposal. Like, you just show up, have your conversation, and we'll produce the thing and tell you when it's coming out and, you know, share it. So that's why they made that very easy on me. I wouldn't have had time to do it myself, I don't think, you know, sit there and produce it and the music and that, and, you know, soliciting advertising and all of that. So
yeah, makes sense. I like it. So I guess the most relevant thing to speak about would be the current situation. What's your current thoughts on like the current state of traditional markets? Personally myself, I don't invest in traditional markets unless it's gold or silver, and I definitely wasn't around in 2008 and 2009 because I was probably a kid right then. But yeah, if what's your opinion on the traditional markets right now?
I mean, I've been pretty outspoken that I think bounces are for shorting. I don't think there's a reversal. I don't think that there's really anything positive in the economy unless you consider $6 trillion of stimulus to be positive.
Which didn't really do much, right?
Right. I mean, you know, there was a bounce for a few days and now it's down. But, you know, as a trader, I think that traditional markets have been exceptionally easy. If you bought anything between 2008 and 2020, you basically couldn't lose, right? So I didn't short a single thing for 12 years as a trader in those markets. And I haven't bought a single thing in a month. I've only shorted every opportunity, right? So playing a macro trend in the stock market is much easier than trading crypto, I think. But my general opinion on the market is this: there's no supply and there's no demand. So how is there an economy?
Right.
And it's so simple to me. I don't understand. I watch CNBC part of the day and, you know, I listen to everybody and the pundits and all their opinions. Everybody's at home. Nobody's buying shit. Nobody has a job. And the supply chain is broken.
Yeah, and they just want cash.
Right. So why would anything go up unless it's artificial? And let's be real, the stock market, you know, the manipulation in the stock market is like, you know, the NBA basketball, and the manipulation on Bitcoin is like a bunch of no armed 4-year-olds playing basketball. You know what I mean? Like, it's not even close. And people criticize Bitcoin for being the most manipulated asset.
Right.
And then you watch senators dumping all their stock a week before the market drops, and you watch $6 trillion of stimulus and all this absurdity. And you just realize that the stock market, you want to call Bitcoin a Ponzi scheme, the stock market is the true Ponzi scheme. You know, so to me, I say short it to the ground, and whatever my last round of shorts I will do will be at the bottom, and I will lose some money on those. And that's fine because I will have shorted it all the way down, and then I'll be ready to go the other way. That said, like, a huge portion of my net worth, I mean, I've been saving for, you know, 15 years or whatever. I'm 43 years old. I have a family. I have retirement accounts and all that stuff. So I've gotten destroyed on the things that I hold. I don't trade my investments aggressively. You know what I mean? So I've watched a lot of this, a lot of my net worth disappear, but that's money that I'm saving for when I'm 65. So I really don't even, this doesn't faze me at all. You know, I continue actually, I have, you know, dollar cost averaging that I do into the market for retirement. So to say I haven't bought anything is a misnomer. I haven't changed my automatic strategy that I will keep for my whole life. But as an active trader, I haven't bought anything.
Yeah, super interesting, because last time I checked on like gold and silver, which was maybe a week ago or 2 weeks ago, it was pretty much at that 2008 level we saw, where we saw the bottom in 2008. How do you determine where you buy? Because after it goes past a certain point, it seems to be just, I don't know, just you're buying it whenever. Because normally you would buy when people are fearful, but we're way past that point now. Like, people are beyond fearful.
So, I believe in buying when people are fearful, but this is different.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, this isn't irrational fear, it's rational fear. Mm. So, you know, it's not as binary as, you know, buying when people are fearful and selling when they're greedy in a situation like this, because it's a true black swan event. You know, the world may not get back to functioning anytime soon. So until that happens, I don't see a bottom. Now, markets do tend to bottom before economies bottom. So even if Right. You know, the economy continues down, GDP continues down, jobs continue down. The market could bottom before that. I just, you know, I'll start buying when I see what seems like a more rational reversal. I probably won't catch the bottom. And, you know, I think when the economy starts up again, things will move rather rapidly in a positive direction. So I think it, because of the black swan, actually the reversal might be a little easier to catch than just irrational panic.
Right.
Because yeah, if people start going back and companies start hiring, you know, and people actually start selling and buying things again, we'll have plenty of room to buy there without catching the exact bottom.
Right. And over the past like 2 years, I've preached so many times that like a recession was just over the horizon, maybe a year or two away. You can just like, once you start reading books and like learning about, like, you can sort of see when the economy is like over leveraged and you can start to determine like where these cycles come and go. But I think maybe it would have been a year or two out from now. But I think this whole coronavirus situation has just kicked everything forward, and now we're in the middle of it.
Yeah, it just pulled the rug, but it was a very thin rug. I mean, you are right that it was coming, and you know, I've been screaming it for a long time. But like you said, I was already thinking it 2 years ago, and I didn't sell everything then. I did sell slowly, kind of on the way up, you know. But it's impossible. You know, they always say markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. So that's why, you know, I guess as a trader and investor, tops and bottoms are somewhat irrelevant, and that's where you just catch knives and you just get destroyed, you know? Right. So, I can't remember the exact numbers, but in a true recession, there's kind of the initial crash, you know, and that's only the first, you know, like 10 or 20% of the move, or even if it's 30%, you generally have a lot of time to sell in a recession or a depression. You know, it kind of continues down. So you don't need to be there the first week. I mean, look, if you look at what's happened in the last month, there are 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 point bounces that all to me were just screaming like, ha ha, short it, you know? And that will continue to happen in my mind. So I think we just had our big oversold bounce, stimulus bounce, and now I think we head back down. You know, a lot of people say we'll retest the lows. I think that we'll retest them from the underside on the way down, but we'll see.
I think maybe, like, let's say you have no trading experience, you don't really know what you're doing, you have a lot of investments and you're not in the market right now. Like, from where I'm standing, and I wouldn't say an expert in traditional markets, but maybe waiting for something like a coronavirus cure, maybe. If they came out with that today or like next week,
I think that would be a signal
to everything should start recovering from them, you know?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of different signals. Like if you're an oil trader and Saudi Arabia and Russia come to a deal tomorrow, which could happen on any given day, I think oil like doubles in a day. You know what I mean? Like you make 100% on your investment overnight, just like you lost 100% when they decided to have a price war, right? But yes, like a really true announcement of an antiviral that works or a vaccine or a cure. I think to me, I mean, I'm obviously not an epidemiologist or a virologist or a physician or anything, but I think, you know, it's rational that an antiviral, some sort of treatment comes way ahead of a vaccine if there's ever a vaccine. I think it's nonsense to assume a vaccine is here anytime soon, if ever. I mean, there's no vaccine for SARS. There's no vaccine for MERS.
Yep.
One of the main versions of the common cold is a coronavirus. There's no vaccine for the coronavirus. I mean, HIV is a completely separate thing, but they've been trying to find a vaccine for HIV for, you know, over 30 years, 40 years. You don't see that. So like to act like it's a slam dunk that they're going to find vaccine for this virus is somewhat absurd. So
no, I think it just slows down and just goes away. That's how these things normally occur.
I hope so. I hope it becomes more like the flu in that, like, at least there's some sort of, you know, a flu vaccine doesn't really work half the time either.
Yeah.
So even that vaccine, but for me, that's like, I just can't really stomach that personally because, you know, my parents are older, my father's immunosuppressed. So does that mean my dad's in quarantine for the rest of his life? Mm. I can't see him, you know? So I think that those realities are the ones that people will struggle with. I do think that a lot of people will get back to life in the coming months. And then I think it'll all happen again.
What about like this? So obviously this narrative has been around for so many years now, but BTC is a hedge against the traditional markets, blah, blah, blah. Didn't work out, did it really? I think people were expecting, I don't know if it, right, let's say we had an economy crash without the coronavirus. Do you think Bitcoin would have dropped that hard? Or do you think people that were holding Bitcoin, a lot of Bitcoin, like proper whales, just wanted cash because they knew fear was coming?
Well, here's the thing. If you look at on-chain metrics, the proper whales have nothing to do with any of this. 70% of the Bitcoin didn't move. It hasn't moved. It's sitting still. Right. So if you consider the 70% that hasn't moved, the probably, I don't know, 5% that's lost, you're talking about all of Bitcoin's price being determined by the movement of perhaps a quarter of the supply. Right. So, and that quarter is shorter term holders and traders and people who are willing to dump it in a bad situation. So like there's a few ways to view this. First, I don't think there's many people who rationally would think that Bitcoin would hold up in a crash like this because it's a risky asset and people never move to risky assets from more stable assets, right? It's just irrational. Yep. So, but to that end, I also don't think it really matters what your average person does because we don't move the price of Bitcoin. We all know that Bitcoin is, you know, price is moved by a few whales that make a decision at any given time. So there's the narrative that whales needed to cover losses in other markets, margin calls, things like that. I can definitely tell you from talking to institutional people that a lot of the hedge funds and stuff that were exposed to Bitcoin just sold it off because, you know, they needed to have cash or have money elsewhere. So I think that happened. But I don't think that Bitcoin should ever have been, and I never viewed it as a hedge against a market crash. It's a hedge against collapsing fiat and hyperinflation, which hasn't happened.
Right.
So I think that is still yet to be determined. I never liked digital gold. I never liked store of value. You know what I mean? Because it just doesn't make sense to me. But I do think that it's still a very important hedge and that everybody should have some. For the worst case scenario, not because like, you know, if you're buying and selling it because the price will be higher or lower at any given time, you're just a trader. You're not hedging with Bitcoin. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think like, a little bit of my like personal preference and like take on this is that, obviously the halving's next month now, and for the every time we've had a halving, always whales move price or manipulators move price, so you get rid of weak hands. It's really pretty common practice in the market. Dump your bags on weak hands, they sell, and then you buy back up lower and you buy their bags, correct?
Absolutely.
So I was just thinking maybe this would be the perfect opportunity where we was like, let's say, 4 months away from the halving. Coronavirus is coming into Europe. It seems like the perfect storm so that you can spread more fear to get more people to sell. That's what I think a little bit.
I mean, that's definitely possible. I think there's also a theory that right now maximum pain could be up because so many people did sell and haven't bought back in. So they just, you know, the classic price goes up. Oh shit. Buy the top. Right. So I think that that's an equally distinct possibility. The thing that makes me hesitant about the narrative that you sort of presented, which yet again, like very possible, it would certainly not surprise me to test those lows again. But the thing that makes me a bit hesitant about that narrative is so much supply was dumped on the market. Mm-hmm. And I do think that most of those people liquidated what they had. Like, I don't know that those same people are holding a whole bunch more to sell. Right. It's possible. But considering, like I said, that we know that 70% of it is sitting off exchange somewhere and has not moved, you know, it's not, there's a finite supply of Bitcoin that's being moved around. Now, of course, then you have leverage and derivatives and, you know, so there's a lot of ways to trade Bitcoin without moving it physically in any way, shape or form. And, you know, many believe, myself included, that the last leg of that move down was a result of, you know, BitMEX's inefficient liquidation engine and price following, hence why we saw, you know, a 50% bounce in 6 hours after the bottom, when they turned BitMEX off. So I just think that, I'm weary of thinking that we're going to go much, much lower again, because it just, someone has to be there to sell that much Bitcoin.
Right. What's your personal opinion on the halvening? I think it's obviously extremely bullish. It cuts the supply in half. Oh, not the supply, sorry, the mining. What's your opinion on it generally over the next 2 to 3 years? Because I would say we're right now a little bit more bullish than we were 2 years ago, right? So that drop we saw from 19,000 down to 3 was a crypto-based crash. Now we're seeing the economy crash and we're at 6K. That's not too bad. This could be a lot worse, I think.
We're at 6K and we started lower. Exactly. So mean, it's. I think that this is a, if you want to skin it that way, this is a better crash, so to speak, right?
And I think once this all blows over, I think we might be good for a little bit.
Right. And I don't think that will be because of the halvening or not. When it comes to Bitcoin, I'm just really a chart guy. You know, I really just kind of trade the chart. So I don't really worry about narrative too much. I kind of laugh it off.
Right.
I don't begrudge anyone who has their narrative and uses it effectively and believes what they believe. That's great. I think to some degree, the halvening would have been more bullish if price was higher. You know, at lower prices, the halvening becomes kind of more of a difficulty for miners, because they're going to have to capitulate. They're not going to make enough money to stay in business at those lower prices. Maybe we're above that floor now. And from everything I've read, and listen, I'm not a tech guy. You know what I mean? Not my thing, but with the fundamentals. But, you know, people who have older generation miners versus the new ASICs and everything, there's going to be a huge disparity there over who survives and who doesn't if price is somewhat low. And anyone who's got energy efficient newer miners that, you know, have lower electric costs should actually do exceptionally well. Yeah. And I think it's going to cull those sort of, you know, the old school miners.
Yeah, I think you're on to something there. It's pretty interesting. Obviously I wanted to get your opinion on this. What does this feel like compared to, let's say, 2008, 2009? Obviously you was investing them times. How does this play up side by side?
It feels really similar. I feel like there was a bit more initially financial desperation the first time, because you didn't have the coronavirus to blame. You know, it was purely a result of greed and mismanaged funds and just, you know, I mean, subprime mortgages and just bad actors and bad practices. You knew who to point the finger at. And whether you were on the side of bailouts or not, you kind of knew they would work, because, you know, it was a money problem. It was really an economic crisis versus a biological crisis, which we have here, that's causing a true economic crisis. I personally think this is much worse. Because, I mean, in 2008, every person didn't have to go in their house and lose their job. It's just the realities of the world right now are so much harder to stomach than that crash. That crash was, as far as a percentage of market loss to this point, that was obviously much, much worse. But then again, I don't think the bottom is in here.
Right.
So, you know, I think you had a lot more people, certainly on Wall Street, jumping out windows and such at that, you know, at this point in that, because, you know, I mean, full companies like Lehman Brothers were out of business, and guys who were used to making millions went to owing millions and, you know, those sort of situations. But I think for your average person, this is a much bigger crisis if it continues. I guess your average person back then was also losing their house because they were over leveraged on bad mortgages. And, you know, as you saw in The Big Short, like strippers owned 7 apartments. And so I don't, you know, I think people in general were a little more responsible this time. So perhaps they're getting destroyed a little less, but I think we could likely be heading down that path with real estate and homes. It'd just be a slower bleed.
How long did that, out of interest, how long did that take to recover until we started to bounce back?
It was a few years, you know. It was sort of you know, there was like, people sort of forget there was this bit of a crash, I believe, in 2007, and then it sort of ripped back up and everyone sort of forgot about it. And then it really started again in 2008, but the signs were there. I mean, I don't remember feeling even decent about anything until 2011 or 2012, you know. And coincidentally, when I got back on my feet, I made the like worst trade of my life. And in 2012, basically like lost a ton on one huge trade that went to zero. So for me, it wasn't really that great of a recovery. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I did make the best financial decision of my life, which is I bought a condo in Miami, which doubled in price in 2 years, and got out of that and was good to go. Nice. So, yeah. But
I also think like one, maybe it's not a big factor actually, but it's pretty significant, is that maybe if like 10 years ago there was social media and stuff, but now you could have anybody putting out charts on Twitter, writing their narrative, and then if they have enough followers, like they don't need any skills, let's say, to get followers, and once they have the followers, they can like sort of switch people's minds. And then we see mass panic selling due to charts and people posting stuff on TradingView, which we didn't have maybe 10 years ago. Maybe that's narrative.
I think that's very true for retail and certainly to our community in general. I don't know that that affects what's happening on a mass scale, but I do think that for us who are exposed to that, that is definitely very true. And forget even the charts and the TradingView and all of that. The velocity and inaccuracy of news now is leaps and bounds ahead of where it was in 2008, 2009, because as you said, I mean, that's Twitter was being invented, you know, like these things, they're really, you still got news from somewhat reliable news sources at that point. They weren't as politically polarized and they weren't necessarily racing for bad scoops and even maybe reported more accurate news, I think would be the case. You know, they actually reported facts. So I think we were getting much better information back then from more reliable sources. So I think that part of it is absolutely true. I mean, you look at how the news, I talk about this all the time, but like how the news sort of the stream has been on COVID, and like everything that everyone said a month ago that everybody espoused as facts is a fucking lie, right? Like, can't get it from this, and it only kills old people, and it's just the flu, and you know, like the WHO, it can't be transmitted person to person from the World Health Organization. And then the World Health Organization 2 days ago said it's not, you know, that it's not airborne, it falls immediately to the ground. And then MIT puts out a study a day later that's like you can get it from 27 feet away.
Jesus Christ.
And it sticks around in the air, floating around like Elsa's frozen snowflakes for 9 hours, right. You know. And so I think the problem is with everything, financial, all news, politics, and especially this disease, is that like there is no such thing as reliable news,
right?
Really. Even the science and facts are like a moving target.
Yeah, I completely agree. Moving on to something else, how would you like describe your trading style? So obviously you post a lot of charts on Twitter, pretty commonly. Are you a trader or like a long-term holder or investor? How does that work?
All of the above. So
cool.
Day trading is not really my style, especially now with kids and other things to do. I'm just not like the type to stare at charts all day and zoom in like crazy. I mean, I think generally I'm an investor, and I think that even the best traders I know only trade with a small portion of their overall portfolio. Right. So for me, like I stick to the classics. I mean, it's a little different for me within crypto, but as a whole, it's 70% investments, 15% cash, 15% to trade with, you know? So I am a trader and I can make a living with that 15% in general, but I would never really extend beyond 15, 20% to use for trading. So if I end up overextending that to some degree in longer term trades, I'll just stop making shorter term trades, you know, or rebalance or whatever. But in general, I'm looking for positions that are days to weeks to months, not hours to a day, you know.
Right.
Just doesn't suit my temperament. And I think that once you have kids and a family and you're really busy, you can't do it, right? I mean, I cannot babysit a trade. So I have to have a specific plan and then set my alarms on it and let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we have a very similar trading style, because I don't trade any alts anymore. I cut that out like a year ago. The last time I bought Bitcoin was February 2018. I've only made Bitcoin from podcasts, sponsorships, articles, like stuff like that. And when I get it, and I just buy Bitcoin or I buy Ethereum, and it just stays in my account, and that's it. And I have more money than I ever started with. Like I have more money than I could ever imagine like having like 2 years ago, you know, because I'm only just fresh out of university. So I just buy it, I hold it, and then I have a trading fund, which is like a few thousand dollars, which is like 10% of what I have. And I just play around with that, let's say in BitMEX or Binance. And then if I see something I like, I trade it. And then that's how it goes, you know? I just buy it, hold it, and that's it. I don't really care about the short term. Yeah, I
mean, you know, I think it's important to have like a trading plan when you enter a trade.
Right.
But like the notion, and this you learn very quick when you become a quote unquote like professional trader, having, at least in my opinion, like having a salary you need to make in a given month, like I haven't hit my quota for the day, I haven't hit my quota for the month, is just the best way to get absolutely destroyed.
Right.
I think that you have to, you know, it's kind of a catch-22. You have to have enough money to be able to sit out for a long time. And most traders are like, in reality, are trying to trade with all their money, so they're forcing it. But like, I might not trade for a month. You know, if I don't see anything I like, I'm just not going to take it. So it's irrelevant what my rent is or what I've got those covered with other things. And I would have never been able to be a trader if I hadn't have had a successful career before and saved money.
I also think a lot of people in our space, they come in, they're fresh off the streets, and they just think, oh, like I signed up to BitMEX and I put a 50 times leverage and, you know, I just make millions. That's not how it works. The people who made millions are the people who bought and did nothing for 7 years.
Yeah, the ones who everyone likes to call lucky, but actually had the balls to hold. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, the early adopters in any space like this are the ones who, you know, who make the real money, them, and then the people who build the tools for a growing industry. You know, like they always say in the gold rush, it's the guys who sold the miners the shovels who made all the money.
Right.
Your exchange owners, you know, your Arthurs and CZs and the guy, you know, and the people behind these coins and the guys who had, you know, huge ICOs. And those are the guys who got rich much more than anyone who was trading or holding it. I mean, trading is a grind. It's like being a professional poker player who sits at the table all day. And, you know, it's not really for everyone. And very few like traders get exceptionally wealthy, certainly retail. Now, like then people will point and be like, well, look at hedge funds and stuff. But those are guys, you know, a hedge fund manager may be a great trader, but a guy like that is rich because he's good at raising money.
Right.
Right. I mean, he's good at raising a fund. They don't have those guys lose money and still make billions. So.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And I think another thing is that like when these people are coming into the space, they just follow other people. And that never goes well. Like the people who post charts on Twitter, they probably post the chart and then they post the trade. They'll exit that trade within 3 or 4 minutes if they're babysitting it, and they wouldn't post like an update, and then people get wrecked. So it's
right. Pretty rough. And I mean, and to that end, like every single trade makes sense for a different person for a different reason, right? Like I might take a trade. But you don't know, even if I post it, like you don't know the size of that trade relative to my stack. You don't know why I took it. You don't know what my timeline is. So, I mean, you know, everybody's financial situation is different. So if I take a trade that's 1% risk and somebody else decides to copy it and risks 50% of their money on it, well, so now I'm the asshole, right? You know, and they blame you. At the end of the day, every single person is responsible for their own financial decisions. And you should not be taking, first of all, you shouldn't be taking any trades ever if you don't understand what you're trading and how. So copying someone else is just going to get you destroyed no matter who that person is and no matter how good they are. Because again, you don't know how they manage their risk on that trade, which is all that truly matters, right? Where they entered is literally the least relevant part of the entire trade, right? It's where their stop loss is, how much of their portfolio that stop loss is, and how they've arranged their take profits and how they plan to exit if things go, you know, in this either direction.
Yeah.
And those are things that can't be expressed in a tweet with a chart.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. That news came out this week that Binance bought, I don't know if the offer, if it went through, but they were buying CoinMarketCap, right? For $400
million? Yeah, CoinMarketCap.
Like, what's your opinion
million.
On that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, CZ is a brilliant businessman who's consolidating power. You know, I don't think it's much different than the Facebooks and Googles of the world in their own spaces who buy ancillary companies that, you know, for various reasons. My assumption, and I know nothing, is that the real reason they would buy that is for the traffic.
And, yeah, definitely. 100%.
I don't know, but it seems like if CMC becomes running permanent ad for Binance, that they're going to do a lot of volume is that.
Yeah,
you know?
It's pretty much, it's just live. It's just a public live API feed that just pulls data. Like, I could make that. But the only reason it's worth $400 million is because I would say that
people,
is...
Because the, people look at
right,
it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's probably, I reckon that's the biggest site in crypto.
I agree. I think it definitely is.
Even more than Binance. Like, the people who use these things, they check CoinMarketCap maybe twice a day, maybe.
Yeah, I saw it listed. I can't recall the numbers because my old brain doesn't work anymore. But I think it does like 10 times the traffic of Binance or even more, larger multiple. It's not even close. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, at the level of traffic CMC is doing, you can basically make the argument that probably, I'm just throwing a percentage out in the air, but like, let's say 50% of people who even own crypto check that every day. Well, that's the most valuable thing you could possibly have as an exchange, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that that's a slam dunk for Binance. It's not like they don't have the money. I don't think it's a head scratcher at all. Some people are like, why would they buy that? It's, you know, I think it's so obvious.
It's pretty common that, well, I've heard a lot that the people who make money in recessions and like crashes like this are the people who build brand, and they focus on buying brand instead of like trading or something.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I know a guy who in Miami, like it really is a buy the blood situation, but in 2008, 2009, you probably don't know, you weren't here, but basically the entire recession was caused by subprime mortgages, and a few major markets really destroyed the entire market. Florida being one, primarily Miami, Las Vegas being another. All the places that people, you know, over leveraged on vacation properties and crazy stuff. You saw The Big Short. So that was all, you know, they flew down to Florida and whatever. So this guy, he didn't have much money. I mean, he was a white collar lawyer, successful, but not millions, but he partnered with one or two people. They figured out how to do a couple deals. Like on South Beach, they bought a parking lot. They bought it for $600,000 and sold it for like $52 million.
Holy shit.
You know, like, and then he found a way that he could buy air rights, which is the right to build a building to a certain height. So certain neighborhoods in Miami, you can either, you know, you can build up to 10 stories or 50. So he found some weird way to buy air rights in one neighborhood and sell them in another. So he was like buying air rights for buildings that didn't exist and literally selling them 24 hours later for like 30 times the amount of money. And this was all like while the whole market was dying. And then the other thing that he was doing in his group, they were just like buying they were buying mortgages. I'm trying to remember exactly how they structured it, but all these people were all obviously defaulting on their mortgages. Mm-hmm. And so everything was pennies on the dollar if you had cash, but he was buying mortgages that he had already sold to the bank for two times as much money. So it, literally all he had to do was like make the deal with the bank and then talk to the guy. And then within 24 hours, he would like buy something for $1 million and sell it for $2 million.
Jesus Christ. That's mad.
So this guy lives now. And I'm talking about a guy who like had a couple hundred grand to his name in 2008. And by 2013 was living in one of the biggest mansions on, you know, one of the islands in Miami.
I think this all ties in quite nicely to like end it, because instead of just like someone new, if someone's listening and they like want to trade or make some money, make some more Bitcoin, stack Bitcoin, like focusing on hustling and making a business and building brand in this space is 100 times going to make you more money than just trading on BitMEX. Like, I cannot stress that
enough. You're going to lose all your money on BitMEX. Right. 99% of the time. Forget even like how much you might make. You're just going to lose.
Yeah. So instead of over-leveraging your money, over-leverage your time and your efforts into the community.
I mean, especially if you're like a single guy right now and you're sitting alone in your apartment. Like, I tweeted the other day jokingly, I was like, the kind of person I am, if I had been a single person or even just a married guy in this time, I would have literally put out like 7 albums by now in my music career. I would have made like 400 songs because I have an overactive brain and I just need to be doing something. Unfortunately, well, fortunately for my children, but that time is going to my family now and to like all the other commitments that I have. Right. But if like you're a single person and you're sitting around right now and you're bored watching Netflix, you're wasting the greatest opportunity you will ever have to leverage your time to make money and create new income streams and to really make sure that you don't get destroyed next time something like this happens.
Yeah, amazing. Do you want to give a quick shout out to like where people can find you, Twitter or websites, stuff you're working on?
Sure. I mean, the easiest place to find me is Twitter. Again, it's at Scott Melker, ScottMelker, and everything else is either listed or discussed there. So that's the best place, man.